That's kind of the story of my life. Always in between, you know? You just never quite there. It's certainly good to be with you today. And it's been, I was just telling my wife, I think it's been probably since the last time I spoke in the south side of Houston, although it was east back then, would have been just about 20 years ago, 94. I think we made a trip over with a group of young people, and I remember speaking there at that point. So it's been a long, long time, and it's just so fascinating to talk with and see the people that we know. Of course, you know, Chris was a young teenager back then, and being able to see the progress that he's made, and the many different ones that we have known through the years, it's a very exciting thing. I know whenever we get together with the Salyers, we sometimes talk about how long we've actually known each other. We do that in very quiet terms so nobody else hears, but it's headed pretty close to 50 years now, and we have certainly appreciated that that opportunity and the chance to be together as we've had those times. Of course, we look around and we recognize that all of us have grown a little bit older as the time goes by. We probably don't think of it in quite that way. I was telling the brethren in Dallas a few weeks ago that actually there's been a change in you know, some of the policies that we have as a result of what we see. In the past, when Mr. Salyer and I were back in college in those first years out in the ministry, there was a ruling that no minister could visit a younger woman alone. It was just a matter of a proper appearance and so on. But that rule has kind of changed, where now a minister is not to visit any woman alone. And the reason for that is all the ministers are so old, all the women are younger now. So we kind of adjusted a little bit as time has gone by. But nonetheless, we still appreciate the opportunities that we have. Certainly a pleasure to me to be able to come down. I will have to say that when we first started making these trips out from Dallas, different ones of us, I was hoping to come down to Houston South very early on. Certainly wanted to see you, but I also learned, to my surprise, that probably one of my very best friends from high school actually lives in League City. And so I thought, well, it sure be great to not only come down and visit the church, but be able to get together. And a few months back, I called and we talked on the phone for a little bit, and it just really drove home to me the point that we've grown in very different directions nowadays. And while I look forward someday to being able to see him again, I was a whole lot more looking forward to seeing you than I was to try to renew that friendship that, you know, fine person, but we're very different today than what we used to be. And I think for all of us, we would be very grateful for that. You know, sometimes people will say, oh, well, you haven't changed a bit. And I think for a church person, that's the last thing you want to hear. I haven't changed. No, I'm really trying to change. So I hope I have. Being at the headquarters office, and especially at Foundation Institute, is for me a very great joy. I really enjoy the process of being able to share God's truth in that kind of an environment with young people. Just being around young people is a fun thing to do. You know, there's an energy, and you just really enjoy being around them. Any of you've been to camp, you've had that experience. You understand what it is. You really get a sense of energy and excitement from being around them, and I certainly enjoy it. We have a very good class this year. We wish that it were a little more balanced between male and female, but you know, you live with what you've got. We have this year 14 young ladies and 5 young men who are there. Well, I'll leave that at 14 young ladies. One of them is a retiree, but I don't dare say anything else. So 14 young ladies and 5 young men who are there. But it seems like a very nice mix, and we've really enjoyed beginning to get to know them. We've had them for a couple of weeks now, and they seem to be very lively and enjoying the chance to be together. And it's just working very, very well. We're excited about being able to move forward this year as we try some new things and bring in some changes that we think will make the program even better. I'll probably, I'm not going to spend time talking with you about that right now, in part because I'm supposed to do In Accord next week, and I need to be able to share it there. So listen to In Accord, and I'll share some of those things with you. We're very excited about the program and what we can do there. And being around the office, again, is a very positive experience. So this weekend, the Franks are in Atlanta. There is making a church visit, but also there's a family wedding taking place back there as well with Mrs. Frank's family. So they're very excited about being back there. The Horchaks, I think, are in Dallas, but they're going to be taking about a week's vacation after coming back from the weeks in Africa. They just would kind of like to be able to catch their breath a little bit and do some of that as well. Others are still around the office, different things going on. We're very excited about it. We have a new employee that's coming in on Tuesday. Mr. Kelly Cunningham is going to come in as a kind of a database manager for us as we're getting that up and running. So there are many things that are involved and a lot going on, but it's a very exciting time and we really enjoy it. Everyone there has, and in the field ministry as well, as I'm sure you know with Mr. Salyer, it seems like everybody's wearing a lot of hats. And we many times kind of wish we could take a couple of those off, but these are things that need to be done. And so we're all busy with a variety of different things in those ways and grateful for the opportunities that we have. So we're very much appreciative of that. Otherwise, I don't know of a great deal of news to pass along to you from up there, but we'll just say things are moving along very well and we're very pleased with how things are going. My wife and I, when we heard that the feast was going to be in Galveston this year, we thought, well, that would be a nice place to be for the feast. We would enjoy going to Galveston. But instead, they said, no, we'd like you to go somewhere else, anywhere else. No, it didn't. It wasn't that way exactly, but they did give us the opportunity this year to split the feast between Australia and New Zealand. So we're looking forward to being able to be with the folks over there. We were in Australia 7 years ago and split between two feast sites. This time it'll be the one site in Australia plus the one in Lake Taupo in New Zealand. We've never been to New Zealand, so looking forward to that as well. I've learned in the process that the longest commercial airline flight in the world is the flight from DFW to Sydney. That is the longest one in the world. It takes a little over 17 hours. Now, I like flying, but after about 2 hours, I'm ready to go outside and play. You know, and I just that's a long one. But being there with the brethren is just such a joy. We're really looking forward to that a great deal. So, if you ever get the opportunity to travel and see them, I can promise you they would love to be able to see you and spend some time with you. I'm trying to get used to this because I have this. I feel like a bird perched on something here and just looking around very wisely like an owl. Anyway, I'll try to be a little more active here. It's just kind of fun to get used to a different lectern. I was telling Mr. Salyer via email yesterday as we were communicating that I was wrestling with a subject today that I wanted to talk about. It's a subject that I really wanted to talk about for quite some time, but the last couple of times I've tried to put it together, it just wouldn't seem to come. So I tried to wrestle with it, and actually, well, I guess you'll have to tell me whether it does or not, but I'm going to try it today, and I think, quite honestly, I was pleased with the way it came together as I worked on this yesterday evening. In the last few weeks, the name Michael Brown in the town of Ferguson, Missouri, has been heard all over the world. Now, this is a familiar thing. I didn't know Michael Brown, of course, but Ferguson, Missouri, I knew very well. I had relatives who lived there. I grew up in the St. Louis area, so was familiar with what the area was like. As you've watched the news, you've probably seen that there have been literally thousands of people from all over the place, even in some cases other countries, who frankly know nothing more than the sketchy news reports that have come out, who have formed solid opinions and chosen their sides over what's being called a cry for justice. The anger, the hostility, the disrespect shown toward authorities are hard for some of us to understand. If your experience has been similar to mine, and I know not all of you have had similar experience to mine, but if your experience was similar to mine, Basically, the police have always been viewed as those who can be counted on in times of difficulty. If we had a serious problem take place in my neighborhood, well, there wouldn't be any hesitancy at all to call the police and ask for their help and expect to receive it. And I think sometimes it's hard for those of us who've had that kind of experience to understand that for very large segments of our population, that isn't the experience they've had. And in fact, in many of our most troubled areas, the police are very often the last people you want to see show up. I think that was driven home to me last year a little bit when one of our FI students, a very fine young Hispanic man who lives back in one of the toughest barrios of Los Angeles, South Central LA. He was walking home late one evening from an outdoor basketball game, and the local police stopped him, forced him to lie face down on the sidewalk, put his hands behind his head, and searched him, all the while questioning him about what he was doing out there so late. Now, he's a very quiet young man, and he was actually quite respectful and honest in talking with them about what he had been doing. He was cooperating. He wasn't sneaking around in the dark somewhere. He was walking down a lighted sidewalk carrying a basketball. That doesn't sound especially dangerous, but that's what he was doing, just walking down the sidewalk carrying a basketball. Admittedly, it was late, approaching midnight, and probably he shouldn't have been out there that late playing basketball, but, you know, that's not sinister in any way. Admittedly, he was wearing a hooded sweatshirt, but it was winter, and it was cold. When the police couldn't find anything wrong, well, they let him go home, but there was never any kind of an apology. Sorry we treated you that way. All they told him was that he needed to lose his hoodie. Now, it's hard for me to understand what it's like to live in an environment like that. And yet here it was as a part of my own community. During the time this young man was at Foundation Institute, he also learned that a friend of his that he had viewed as almost a brother had been killed in a drive-by shooting out in, again, South Central LA. That was the environment he grew up in. It was difficult. It's a very different way, and those who live in that kind of an environment tend to view authority and those in authority in a very different way than perhaps you and I do. Now, of course, the situation of that case in Missouri and what took place in Allen, those situations that come up in that way, really only one of or two of many situations that are similar, where people who would normally be treated with respect are instead treated with anger, suspicion, and disrespect. Thanks to talk radio, the internet, and the general breakdown of any sense of respect in our society, many people feel that it's perfectly acceptable to show their disdain for any and all with whom they disagree. Yesterday, I was driving, picking up a couple of things, and in front of me was a pickup truck covered with bumper stickers, all of them critical of our current president and the policies that the government has and so on. And they weren't nicely critical, okay, let's put it that way. They were hostile. They were disrespectful. They were disdainful. Yet this individual felt that he had every right to be able to put that out there for everyone to see. Regardless of how much we may disagree about some decision that those in authority may make, is it acceptable for us, for you and me as Christians, to get caught up in that kind of disrespectful behavior? One of the things that I try to bring out as I often talk with the students and sometimes in messages as well is the subtle influence of Satan that we very often don't pay attention to. If we think about, now again, I think most of us understand that there are certainly many ways in which Satan and demonic things have become a part of our society. Vampire worship and all of this kind of thing that seems to be a part of the entertainment world. All of those things that we recognize. Well, you and I know very well that the paranormal is one of those areas where we certainly want to avoid it. Satan's influence is very clearly there. But as I sometimes put it, I think Satan's greatest power is not the paranormal. It's what I call the power of the normal. It is when Satan can get you and I to accept something as normal, when in fact, it isn't right at all. It's evil. It's wrong. But we begin to accept it. And if he can convince us that those things are normal, then we quietly accept them and let them be a part of our lives, when in fact, they're very displeasing to God. I think the power of the normal is something that we have to be aware of. We have to examine our lives continually to see, am I allowing something to be a part of my life, my thinking, my actions, my way of living, that in fact isn't really right with God at all, regardless of how normal it may be in the world that I'm a part of. I think probably that attitude of disrespect for God, for his servants, for his plan, coupled with his pride, is what led Satan down the path of rebellion in the first place. The path that's produced the chaos that we see in the world around us, and I don't think anybody can deny that we are in a very chaotic world right now, and recognize that it's going to be worse. Now, about this point, if you react as I would to hearing these words, you've probably been thinking about times when maybe you have been a bit disrespectful toward some authority figure, or simply discourteous to someone around you, whether they have authority or not. And you may be thinking, yeah, you know, that's right. I need to be more careful about what I say. And that's fine. That's good. I'm glad if you looked at it and you've thought that already. That's a good thing for all of us to do. If making you feel guilty and resolving to do better is the object of my message today, then I can consider my job here complete. I can shut up, go sit down, we'll all be relieved. But could it be that there's something more important here, something spiritual, that is important to God? Do you ever ask, you know, one of the things I remember Mr. Armstrong said about himself is that he was a person who liked to ask why. That even as a child, he asked why. Do you do that? Do you ever ask, why is that? I don't mean necessarily, you know, something happens and you think, well, why didn't God step in? Why didn't he intervene? Well, yeah, I suppose we ask those questions sometimes too. As I read the Psalms, I certainly see that David asked those questions. But what about in our lives? When we read something in Scripture, we see a standard that God expects of us. Do we ever stop and say, I wonder why that is? Why does God instruct us to do that? Why does he give this instruction or that command? Do you ever go to him and say, why did you tell us to do it that way? Again, I'm not saying in a disrespectful way. I'm just simply saying you go to God and say, you know, I don't think I fully understand this. Why is that? Last year at Foundation Institute, one of the things that we instituted was a once-a-month Bible study. We call it First Friday. And we get together. We have kind of a casual meal together on a Friday evening. And then we have a Bible study. Different ones of us will take those. And last year, as it was my turn, I tried a Bible study in which I took the Ten Commandments and I printed them on cards and turned them upside down so no one could see what the cards were, and had people just randomly pick a card, read to everybody what that commandment was, and then ask the question, why? Why is that a command that God's given? And I found that many times the students really struggled with that. They really had trouble coming up with the whys. And I was a little disappointed, but some of us were talking about it later on. And the point was made, well, you know, maybe it takes a certain level of spiritual maturity. That when you're young, you're concentrating on what and how. And you don't necessarily take the time to ask, why? Why is it that way? Why is this a command? Why does God say this or that? I hope that was it, and again, I probably will do pretty much the same thing this year as I have the chance to deal with them, because I think it's so important for us sometimes to say, why is that? Why did God say this? The final verses of Hebrews 5, the first few verses of chapter 6, tell us that it is not good enough to remain at a spiritually immature level, but rather that we are to go on to perfection. And the word there, perfection, has to do with a maturing, with reaching a level of maturity where God can actually use you in the way he intended when he called you. We understand the phrase of going on to maturity to mean we need to be growing in spiritual maturity so that we're able to be the tools that God intended us to be when he called us, that he can use us in the way that he intends. Now, I know that sometimes people insist on seeing God's commands as negatives. Well, you can't do this and you can't do that. But I think most of us have been around long enough to recognize that many of God's instructions are given in positive terms. And even those that sometimes may sound initially as a negative have a positive side to them as well. For the most part, the instructions about godly respect are given in positive terms. It's almost as if God says, first, quit doing the things that are overtly sinful. But that's not enough. Once you've done that, then you begin to learn how to start doing the positive things that actually make you useful. I use a metaphor. I said a tool. If I use that metaphor and talk about it, if you had an old, rusty, bent-up saw blade with nicks and so on in it, and you took that saw blade and you very carefully straightened it out, took care of the nicks, the bends, made it smooth so it appears to be usable, it's still not a sharp saw blade. You've got to add something more to it before it's really a usable tool. And similarly for you and me, as God begins to work with us, cleaning up the mess we've made of our lives is only the starting place. There has to be a refining. There has to be more to enable us to become the kind of tool God wants us to be. Now let's apply that metaphor to the subject of godly respect. Let's begin by turning back to Romans chapter 13. Romans 13. This is where I ran into a problem as I started putting this message together. Again, actually several months ago as I began trying to get it together. As I began to look at this, I found scores of scriptures that relate to this. Way too many to use in a sermon. So I had to go back and kind of trim this out a little bit, but let's see if we can learn some lessons here. Romans 13, notice what he says here in verse 7. Romans 13, verse 7. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, referring to custom duties, not customs like shaking hands or things like that. We're talking about paying customs, as if you were going through customs at an international checkpoint. Fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. We are told in this passage by God that there are people to whom we owe honor. Honor is due to those people, just like taxes are due to the government. We can no more be excused from showing that godly honor than we can simply be excused from paying taxes. So what does God expect of you and me in fulfilling what is a positive command? He doesn't say here, don't show dishonor. He says, you owe honor. That there are people to whom you and I owe something in a positive way, we owe honor. What does it mean to show honor to whom honor is due? Let's keep a fundamental principle in mind as we look at the passages and the scriptures that go with this. Honor and respect, or even for that matter, disrespect, are attitudes of the mind. But the attitudes produce outward manifestations in the way we treat those that we honor. Honor that is only felt in the mind is of very little value. Just as James says that faith without works is dead, honor without outward expression of that honor, pretty much lifeless as well, doesn't accomplish much of anything. The honor that we, very limited, mortal human beings, should have toward the Creator is actually established from the very first words of Scripture. As you read through the very first chapter of Genesis, I'm not turning back there, but we've probably all read through there many times, there's some of the most wonderful lessons that are there. And sometimes I think we may kind of overlook the idea behind what those words tell us. You see, sometimes, and again, I think it's a matter of growth as time goes by, we see these things a little differently. Initially, when we read through that first chapter of Genesis, we probably read it as if it's a history, okay? Here's the history of how everything that we call the world came into existence, okay? Is it that? Yes, yeah, that's legitimate. It is a history, okay? We learn certain things in that way. Is it a science textbook? Well, not exactly, but at the same time, as we understand it, it doesn't conflict with science either. It's perfectly legitimate to recognize that there's not a conflict between what God tells us and what science can tell us. So we begin to see it a little bit differently. But I think there's another lesson in Genesis chapter 1 that's important to keep in mind as well. It is, in a sense, as if as we begin this examination of this incredible book, the author has what we call it, a prologue. The author has a prologue. And the author introduces himself to us. He tells us who he is, what his background is, so to speak, and what that should mean to us. In other words, he begins by telling us, okay, everything that exists, I brought it into existence. When you come on the scene, there's darkness. I brought in light. I separated day and night. I took, and literally the Hebrew word for create there is bara, which essentially means to bring into existence from nothing. So basically God said, okay, who am I? I am the one who took nothing and made something of it. I took nothing and made matter. And then I took that matter and I made some of it alive. That's a neat trick. Okay, I made it alive. And then I not only made it alive like plants, but I gave it brain with instinct, so it's able to move around, reproduce after its own kind, do certain things over and over and over again. Have you ever studied, like, for example, there's a bird that's found in South Africa and some other places called a weaver bird. And this weaver bird, when it makes a nest, the nest is about this long. And it's got an entry to get into the nest. It's not just an open top, but you have to climb up, and there's almost like a little trap door, and the bird goes in and then back down. It's a unique nest this weaver bird makes. Back about the turn of the 20th century, one of the scientists who was over there was just fascinated by this, so he did an experiment. He took weaver birds and he kept them in cages without any nest building material whatsoever for 3 or 4 or 5 generations. And then he let those birds that had never ever seen a weaver bird nest, he let them have access to that material. And they built exactly the same kind of nest. It was so wired into their instinct. Now, in essence, I use that simply as an example that God made animals with instincts and they're able to do things. This is the God who took nothing, made matter, made it live, made it move around and have brain and instinct. And then he says, oh, by the way, I also did something else. I took matter and I made it think. Again, do you stop and think about what is it? He made it think. He created you and me with the ability to think and to reason and to make moral choices. Things that, I mean, how do you even imagine that? you would find if you go back, I won't go to the passage, but there's a passage in the book of Zechariah where it talks about three things that set God apart as being worthy of glory and worship. And it has to do with those creative things. And the third one that it mentions is the spirit in man, the ability of human beings to think and to reason. What an amazing thing. And then, I guess for you and me, we would also say that if we carried that over into the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, we would also see that God says, oh, one more thing, I created holy time. And I blessed time. And I set time apart from other time in a unique way, in a continuing way. So, yes, chapter 1 of Genesis is, in a sense, a history. Yes, it's in a sense a scientific thing. But I also see in this that when I read it, I am reminded that the author of this book, the book that wants to tell me how I should live my life, has also taken the time to say, here's why I have the right to tell you how to live. I made it all. I made you. I did all of these things, and therefore, what I'm going to tell you about how to live your life is something you ought to pay attention to, okay? So he begins to show us that. And I think as you go through, as time goes by, probably many of us have had the experience, you read through Genesis 1, and as you go back, as the years go by, you read it again and you think about it, you continually see more and more and more that you didn't recognize before. Now, it's not just true there. It's true throughout the scripture. We all have that experience. But you continue to see things, and you realize more about this God that we're called to serve. You read through a passage like that, and you are left with an overwhelming sense of awe. This is the God who brought us into existence. You read those words with any degree of understanding, and you are left with a sense of amazement. Amazement, not only of what God has done, but amazement that you and I should have the ability to come into the presence of that God and bring our needs and our concerns before Him for His consideration and intervention. That's pretty amazing. When you read that and understand who this God is, and He invites you into His presence and says, I will use the same kind of power that I had to bring all of this from nothing, and I'll take a hand in your life. And we get to ask Him to do that. That's amazing. If you're like me, I think that's a section that never seems to grow old. Every time I come back to it, I'm inspired and I'm awed all over again. Who am I? Who am I that I should have access to the being who did all of those amazing things? And who am I that I should ask Him to use His power for my benefit? Now, I think it's also interesting that when God was speaking to ancient Israel at Mount Sinai, and He begins to give to them the terms of His covenant, a part of that covenant included laws that had already been in existence. We call them the Ten Commandments. Did you ever notice how God introduces the Ten Commandments? Let's turn back there to Exodus 20. Notice how God introduces this section. Many times people look at this and they think of God's commandments as being negative. But there's a great deal of positive here as we go through this as well. We start out here and we find, God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In other words, His first words to them are not, do this, don't do that. His first words are, you're standing here at the foot of the mountain. You're feeling the land shake underneath you. You're seeing the mountain in flames. You're hearing this rumbling voice because I brought you here. Four centuries you were slaves in Egypt. You cried out, you wanted to leave, you had no power, and I brought you here. You are standing in front of me experiencing this because I'm the one who brought you here. Please listen to me. Please pay attention to what I have to tell you about how to live your life. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above and the earth beneath or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, not jealous in a negative way, but jealous in the sense of I demand an exclusive relationship with you. I don't want to share you with some other being or some other God. I want an exclusive relationship with you, like a marriage. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, carelessly, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. We then read from verse 8 through verse 11, the command about the Sabbath day. Now think of this. Several of these commands contain an element of honor and respect directed toward God. We often say the first four are directed to love toward God, the last six love toward man. That's perfectly legitimate. There's certainly nothing wrong with that understanding. But also understand there's a level of honor and respect that's described here too. He first of all says, don't worship anything else as God. Your respect, your honor, your focus is toward God. Our honor toward God is exclusive. He tells us, don't make an image, because there is no image you could ever make, no matter how wonderful, no matter how expensive, no matter how decorated, no matter how beautifully artistic, that could ever even begin to scratch the surface of representing God. And if you have that image, you're going to have a limited concept of the God that you're called to serve. So don't have an image. It's going to hurt you. If you disrespect my name, God says, you're disrespecting me. Because my name reveals what I am. It tells you who I am and what I am and what my character is. And if you are careless with that, then you're not really going to understand who I am. And that's going to hurt you. God tells us that he gives us a day set aside. But again, it's one of those things that I hope all of us understand by this point in our lives, that sometimes people read the command about the Sabbath day and they read it as if it's a one-day-a-week command. I used to ask people, can you break the Sabbath commandment on Tuesday? And sometimes people would say, well, no, most people would say, I ain't answering. No, it's a trick question. I'm not going to answer. No, it's not a trick question. Yeah, you can break the Sabbath command on Tuesday. And I'm not talking about, oh yeah, Tuesday might be a holy day. No, I don't mean it that way. The commandment isn't simply to keep the seventh day. The command is remember the Sabbath day to, for the purpose of, keeping it holy. If I don't remember the Sabbath is coming on Tuesday, then I don't do the things I need to do on Tuesday to be prepared so that I can keep the Sabbath holy when it comes. So yeah, I have to think all week long. One of the Jewish commentaries says that they apply it in the sense of saying a woman who goes to the market on Wednesday and sees some special treat, because she has the Sabbath in mind, buys that treat, takes it home, saves it so that she can share it with her family on the Sabbath. That's remembering the Sabbath to keep it holy. It's one of the reasons why I don't like some of the modern translations that just say, remember to keep the Sabbath holy. No, it isn't what it says. It's to be constantly a part of our minds. And isn't it for you? You think all week long, the Sabbath is coming, I need to be prepared. One day I've got to mow my grass. We all know about that in this part of the world. I got to mow my grass. That's from, what is it, February to December, I think, here we do that. Okay, I've got a plan for that. We need to prepare meals. The house, you know, we want the house to be neat and clean so we're not distracted by something on the Sabbath. So we think about it all week long. Yes, that's a part of God's instruction. And that's a matter of God says, I've set aside some time I want to spend with you. And I want you to spend it with me and with your brothers and sisters, with as a family. I want you to have that time. So remember it all week long so you can be prepared and do that. It's an honor to come into the presence of God and share these things. And then we come to a commandment that specifically addresses honor at its most basic level in the home. Verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Ephesians calls this, or Paul calls it in Ephesians, the first commandment with promise. There's a promise with it. Do this, and it will produce a good result in your life. It produces a result of your days being long, not premature death, not things happening to you because of your foolishness. Now, there are certainly other passages that tell us that disrespect toward a father or mother is a serious matter. One passage, for example, it even calls it a capital offense. That's a very serious matter in that way. But in a sense, those are corollaries to this. The original command is given in very positive terms. You shall honor father and mother. Is there a difference between honoring a parent and simply refraining from dishonoring a parent? Are those the same thing? As long as we don't dishonor, then we fulfill the command to honor. Is that true? Well, no, I see heads shaking out there. Good, I'm glad. You're either shaking yourself awake or you're agreeing with me. Okay. No, we understand that honor is a positive action. It's not just simply a not doing something negative. There is a positive involved in it. And we are to extend that honor toward father and mother. Now, again, we come back to this principle. Why? Why would God make something like that a part of the Ten Commandments? I mean, this is the foundation upon which life is built as far as the actions that we're supposed to have. Why would he do that? What's so important about having honor towards your parents? Well, we could probably, I almost wish we had time to just kind of open it up for discussion and talk about that, but I think we could probably all come up with a lot of good reasons why it's important. When you have that attitude of honor and respect toward your parents, it's going to be a lot easier to listen to them, isn't it? It's going to be a lot easier to take advice from them, to even take correction from them when it's needed, because you honor them. You have that respect toward them. I wonder sometimes, maybe your experience is different than mine, but, you know, I grew up in a home that I think basically was a pretty functional home in many ways. And my parents stayed together throughout all of my life. And, you know, there was an approach that I think was positive overall. But I've learned a lot more about honoring my parents these days since they're gone than I think I even did when they were alive. I've learned more. I wish I'd been more honorable. I wish I'd shown a little more honor. Not that I was a disrespectful person. I was a delightful child, I'm sure. But I wish I'd been more positive in expressing honor in those ways. When we have that sense of honor toward our parents, we're able to listen, we're able to understand, we're able to respond, we're able to learn from their experience. You know, I remember years ago, it was a sermon I gave Houston East years ago. I can remember that far back. And I remember in one point making the statement about child rearing. And I said, you know, if you want to know about child rearing, one of the things you ought to do is talk to people who have done a good job of it and ask them, what did you do? How did you accomplish this? And so on. And I remember a gentleman, very fine gentleman, came to me afterward and he said, you know, I appreciate that point, but he said, sometimes you can learn a lot talking to the people who look back now and realize they made mistakes too. And they can tell you, you know, don't do this one. I made that mistake, and that wasn't the best way to do it. When we honor people, we can listen, we can learn, and in the process, we avoid making the same dumb mistakes over again that it seems that every generation makes. So God gives us a command, and he says, look, I want you to do something positive. I want you to honor your parents. Now, it's certainly correct that the next five commandments after this all focus on loving your neighbor in a godly way. But they also include an element of respect. Respect for your neighbor, respect for the things that belong to them, respect for their lives and their families. It's clear that God wants this concept of honor and respect to be learned from the very earliest days in the environment of a family. That's something that's important to teach and to learn. Honor and respect has to be taught toward others, not only who are in the family, but those who are outside. But the foundation where a child learns what honor and respect are about begins in the family with that child's own parents. A child that's not taught that principle of honor and respect by his parents in the home environment is actually being placed under a curse. Now, I'm not talking about some supernatural curse. I'm not saying God sits on his throne and supernaturally curses someone. But I'm saying if you don't learn to be respectful and honor those who should be respected and honored, you are living your life under a curse. You're going to suffer as a result of that. It's not some mystical thing. It's a natural, normal result. If we don't honor people, we're going to make so many foolish and empty mistakes, and we're going to cut ourselves off from so many blessings. Though the concept of respect properly begins in the home, have you ever considered all the other individuals that God specifically instructs us to respect? How are we doing showing the godly respect God tells us to show, showing honor to whom honor is due? Now, I want to consider in the next few moments a few passages of Scripture. And as we consider them, ask yourself something. Ask yourselves how the attitude of honor and respect would show itself in someone's life. It's kind of like the phrase, I don't particularly care for his advice very much, but I love the phrase that Dr. Phil uses. What's that look like? What's that look like? You talk about honor, honor toward parent, honor toward someone else. What's that look like? How does that translate into actual actions? Not just how you think when you're in private all by yourself. Oh, how you think's important. But it should produce something else. It should produce a way of living. So as we look at some of these passages, let's ask ourselves about that. Let's go back to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. And this is a fascinating chapter. It's one of my favorite chapters in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 12. And Paul gives some very practical application of what we should be doing here. Notice verse 10. Romans 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. Okay? Again, we would ask ourselves, what's that look like? How does that manifest itself? How do I show this as I deal with others? And then he uses this phrase, in honor, giving preference to one another. What does that mean? In honor, giving preference to one another. One of the other translations, I like it, looks at this phrase that says giving preference literally means to go before, to go ahead of someone as a guide would go ahead. In other words, it means take the lead, show the way. So when it comes to honor toward one another, he's saying, take the lead, show the way. You be the one who is proactive in showing honor. You don't wait for somebody else to treat you in a certain way and then you respond. No, this is something that you start with. You lead the way in showing honor to others. Children have to be taught, not only by word, but by example, to show the appropriate honor to their parents, their teachers, elderly people, those who are in positions of authority. All those different ones that, again, I think about it, and I think for most of you, I see gray hairs out there, and some of you even lost those, but I see a people who probably were taught, much as I was, that you're supposed to be respectful toward certain people. And again, teachers were probably included in that, probably people in official capacities. But again, I just think we were taught, and I would assume most of you were as well, anybody basically who's older than you, you are to treat with a degree of respect, and you talk to them in that way, respectfully. Sadly, in our society, it isn't done that way many times. So we have to teach. We have to show by our word and by our example the honor that should be there. When we do that, we're not doing it because this person's ego needs it. We're doing it because it's good for us, and it's good for children to learn to be respectful of people, of places, even of things that should be respected. I mentioned being here 20 years ago. We brought a group of teenagers over from Louisiana, I remember, and we were doing some touring, and we took them down to San Antonio. And of course, in San Antonio, most famous thing there, the Alamo. Okay. We took them in, and there were two or three of the fellows as we took them in that they were laughing and giggling and kind of cutting up and so on. And I remember I had to just stop and say, "Fellas, come here a minute, let's talk." I said, "You don't seem to understand. This place, in the history of Texas, is almost a sacred place. This isn't a place to come and play and laugh and cut up. This is a place to show your respect." And they were fine with it. I mean, they were not bad kids. They just didn't realize. But sometimes we have to help people understand. You know, there are places, there are things where you need to show a certain level of respect in a different way than what you normally would. When we're quick to show a genuine honor, not just a pretense of honor, we become less concerned with whether people are honoring us or not. I'm not as worried about it. We're more concerned about making sure that we're being showing the honor that we should. Let's go a little further back. 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy 5. Very short verse on this, but I think it's an important one. 1 Timothy 5, the subject that he's talking about as we get into this chapter is about widows, orphans, people who are in need and really don't have the power to care for themselves. And he says this in verse 3, honor widows who are really widows. Now it goes on to explain that there are those who have family, who have children, who have family that are there to take care of them, and the family has that duty and responsibility. That's a part of what we have to learn and live with. That's fine. But there are those who don't have anybody. And he said, in those situations, you need to make sure their needs are met. But it's more than that. It isn't just provide financially for those who really are in need. The word that he uses is honor. And when you examine this word, it is a word which means an honor based upon an evaluation of that individual's value and worth. It means you, as you deal with a widow, need to recognize the worth and the value this person has. Now, if you've ever had the chance to be around many of our church widows, you will find what a wonderful group of people they are. We used to say that whenever you have a problem, if you can get the widows to pray for you, you don't have to worry about it. There is an attitude and a spirit there that is very positive and very good. But it's showing here that the honor that should be shown there is not simply an honor. It's not like, oh, well, little old widow, yeah, we better be honor, show her some honor and respect. No, it is an honor that's based upon a genuine realization. This is a valuable person. This person has learned some very important lessons. This person was chosen by God. This person can teach me some things. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. He says here, toward the end of this chapter, 1 Peter 2, and verse 17. 1 Peter 2, verse 17. Honor all people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. And what's he telling us? He's telling us that there is a responsibility we have to show respect, to treat people in a certain way. He says, honor all people, whoever they are, wherever they are, whatever their responsibility is, you treat them with a certain level of respect and honor. There is an assumption, so to speak, that when you meet them, they are worthy of your respect. That's how you treat them. Now, again, many of us have many opportunities to do this. We perhaps go into a restaurant and there's someone who comes and serves you. Do we treat them with respect? That's a part of what it says here. There's supposed to be an honor toward whoever the person is. We walk into an exclusive department store like Walmart, and we've got a checker there who, you know, maybe they're doing a good job, maybe they're not, but our approach to the individual is one of respect. It starts out in that direction. That's the way we're supposed to be. Now, he says, when you're dealing with the brotherhood, take it up a notch. You honor everybody, and that certainly includes the brethren, but there is a love for God's people that takes it even a little bit higher. When it comes to rulers, well, your fear is toward God. You recognize that your greatest responsibility is toward God. But when it comes to the rulers, kings, presidents, governors, whoever they may be, honor them. There is to be an honor. It doesn't say if you agree with them. It doesn't say honor them if they're the same political party that you want to be a part of. I don't know why any of us would want to be a part of any political party, but nonetheless. It doesn't say honor them if this is who they are, period. You owe them honor. As a Christian, you owe them honor. Remember years ago, I remember someone asking, it was back during those days when Mr. Armstrong was doing a great deal of traveling, visiting different people, and they said, Mr. Armstrong, what would you do if you had the opportunity to meet the Pope? And I remember his response was, I would treat him with the honor and respect due to an individual in that kind of responsible position. Mr. Armstrong understood that. And he would have treated them in that way. Now let's go just a little bit further. The next chapter, I think there's a fascinating example of honor here as well. 1 Peter 3, in the first few verses, talk about wives being submissive to their own husbands. Yeah, let's talk about that. That's good. Yeah, okay. It's kind of interesting, frankly, that when you read through the entirety of the scripture that talks about wives being submissive, every time the verses that are written to the wives, there is never a verse that says, husbands, make your wives submit. It is always written to the wife and said, here's what God expects of you. And she is responsible as an adult before God to make the right choices. But I want to go down to verse 7. Husbands, likewise. Now, I'm kind of skipping over because the word likewise is really kind of an important word here. In the end of chapter 2, it talks about the example of Jesus Christ, who was treated badly and yet committed himself to God and trusted God. And in verse 1, it says, wives, likewise. Okay? Following the example of Jesus Christ, here's what you're to do. And then verse 7, husbands, likewise. Okay? Here's your example you're looking to. Dwell with them, referring to your wife, with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Again, we could spend a lot of time talking about this whole verse, but I simply want to note that he says, husbands, you are expected by God to give honor to your wife. That's the same as just not saying anything bad about her, right? That's the same as not sitting around with your buddies and saying, man, you wouldn't believe what my wife did. Oh, man, it's crazy. Is that really what it is? Or is there instead an honor? That when you see this man and you hear his words and he talks about his wife, that you see and hear in him a sense of respect and honor toward this woman who's sharing her life with him. That's what it describes there. I remember very early on in our marriage, my wife noted something and brought it to my attention, which I frankly, looking back on it, it was a very positive thing. My wife and I, again, most of you know us, we have a sense of humor. You will notice I didn't say a good one. I just said a sense of humor. And And we enjoy kidding one another. I mean, it really, that's one of those things that we will do. We did that in the car on the way down here today. And, you know, I mean, it's just a part of the relationship that we have. We enjoy that. But one of the things that she brought out to my attention was early on, I think it was probably in the first year, 2 years of our marriage, we would get together with other people and, you know, we enjoyed telling funny stories and so on. And we would tell funny stories about each other. And it wasn't intended to be disrespectful, but nonetheless, we would take turns telling funny stories about what the other one did. And she brought it to my attention, do you realize this is what we're doing? And I didn't. And we talked about it, and I thought about it, and we began to change that. Because we realized that, quite honestly, this gives an impression not of honor, but of dishonor, disrespect. And I think that's been a very good thing. Oh, we still kid one another. I won't tell you the things that we say, but we kid one another, believe me, and we have a good time. Laughter is a very big part of our relationship, but nonetheless, it talks here about husbands dealing with their wives with a sense of honor, dignity, respect. That's an important thing. And for those of you who are still single, think about that. Do you want to live your life with somebody who really doesn't respect you? Or do you want to be with somebody who shows a genuine sense of appreciation and respect? Did you realize that even the scripture tells us there are some people you should not give honor to? Look very quickly at a passage, Proverbs 26. Proverbs 26 and verse 8. Proverbs 26 and verse 8. Solomon writes, like one who binds a stone in a sling is he who gives honor to a fool. Now think about the old sling that was used where they had the two straps with the stone in the pocket, and they would whirl it around and then let go of one of the strings and the stone would go flying out toward whatever it was. And they were, again, very accurate with that. King David with, or David the shepherd, I guess I should say, with Goliath as an example. But what it says here, it's like instead of that, it's like you took the stone and instead of placing it in the pocket so it could come flying out, instead you tie it in there so it can't come out. What happens then? Swing it around, let go. Uh-oh. Once it reaches the end of that, it's going to come flying right back here. So it said, you start giving honor to someone who insists on being a fool, and it's going to come back on you. So God is, again, recognizing there are situations where, again, it doesn't say dishonor the fool. It doesn't say disrespect him. It doesn't say bad things. But where a person chooses to go the wrong direction, okay, that's a different matter. Now, so far up to this point, we focused on honoring other people, especially our spiritual brothers and sisters. That's fine. That's very important for producing the love and the unity within the church. But is that really all there is to it? If we fulfill these verses we just read, and they are positive commands to honor rather than corrections for dishonor, is that enough? Is that adequate? There's another word that's used in both the Old Testament and the New, which describes the kind of respect and honor we're to show God. That word is reverence. Reverence. How are we at that? How important is it? Again, let's look quickly at just a few passages. We're already here in Proverbs 26. Let's just go up a page to Proverbs 28. Proverbs 28 and verse 14. Proverbs 28, verse 14. Happy is the man who is always reverent. He who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. There is a joy. There is a blessing that comes from always being reverent, respectful toward God. Psalm 89. Psalm 89. And again, just one verse. Verse 7. Psalm 89 and verse 7. God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints and to be held in reverence by those who are all around him. Specifically told. There is an attitude, and not simply an attitude, but action that's going to show as a result of our respect toward God. Let me just quote one more. You don't necessarily have to turn back to it, but you've all heard it, I'm sure. It's in the beginning of the book of Malachi, Malachi 1 and verse 6, where God speaks and he says, "A son honors his father and a servant his master. If I then am of the father, where's my honor? If I'm a master, where's my reverence?" says the Lord of hosts. "To you priests who despise my name." And the response of those who hear this is, "In what way have we despised your name? Oh, we're not guilty of that." They fail to even recognize their own lack of respect toward God. Why does God instruct us to have reverence toward him? Does our respect or our lack of respect change God in some way? It's not for God's benefit that we're told to have reverence for him. It's for ours. And again, we have to ask that question. What does reverence toward God look like? How would godly reverence show itself in the life of a Christian? The attitude of reverence has to be at the core, but it should produce actions in our lives that are commensurate with that attitude of reverence. Now, I think of a very simple thing that I heard years ago from the man who was at the time the deputy chancellor of Ambassador College in Big Sandy, Les McCullough. It may seem like a very small thing, probably is a very small thing in some ways, but it really made an impression in my mind. He was telling us about the proper relationship with God and so on. I don't remember the full context of it, but he told us that one of the things he always did, he prayed every day, every morning when he got up, he went and prayed, but before he would go pray, he would go in the bathroom and comb his hair. Now, did God need him to comb his hair? No. But the point was, it was making an impression in his mind. I'm not just rolling out of bed and talking to my buddy. I'm coming into the presence of God, and I need to do so respectfully. And I will say that that's, you know, it's kind of an odd thing, but that's one of the things I remember and I picked up. I still do that today myself. I get up in the morning and I comb my hair before I go talk to God. It reminds me of something. In a similar way, you know, sometimes people say, "Well, I don't see why I need to kneel to pray to God." No, you can pray to God in all kinds of different positions. But when you kneel, it reminds you of who you are and who he is. And that's very important, to be able to talk to God. Titus chapter 2, it shows another way in which this attitude of reverence toward God is going to manifest itself. Titus chapter 2, starting in verse 6. Titus 2, verse 6. Paul writes to Titus, "Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded." That doesn't mean sad, it just means to recognize that there's a time in life to be serious. "In all things, showing yourself," okay, Titus, here's what I expect of you, and obviously for us, "showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who's an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you." We are told that when it comes to our beliefs, those beliefs are to be approached with a spirit of reverence, a spirit of recognizing this is not something to take lightly. This is not something where I can be careless. This isn't just about nice relationships that we have with one another. I sometimes hear people make this statement, "Well, the Bible is all about relationships." Okay. I could also say the Bible is all about law. The Bible is all about the gospel. The Bible is all about the kingdom. The Bible is all about how we deal with God and approach him. I mean, all of that's there. To make the statement the Bible is all about relationships is really a pretty senseless statement. It doesn't really mean anything. There's much more to it. And it needs to show the way in the way that we live our lives. Now, why am I making a big deal out of this? Quite honestly, several months back, I was listening to a sermon given by one of the ministers who was in the Dallas area at the time, and he read a passage, and he was applying it to something entirely different. But it caught my attention, and I've been thinking about it ever since. It's in the book of Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus 26. And we all know Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, we call these the blessing and cursing chapters and so on, and the specific instruction that's given. The very last phrase that's used at the end of chapter 25 is, I am the Lord your God, I'm speaking to you. And he talks about what people are to do. He talks about idolatry in verse 1. And in verse 2 he says this, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Now, when it comes to keeping the Sabbaths, oh, we've believed that for a long time. And probably when we read that verse, that's the first thing that leaps out at us. Yeah, we're supposed to keep the Sabbath. That's right. Yes, we are. But what about that other phrase? You shall reverence my sanctuary. How am I doing on that? Does that even cross my mind? Am I showing the reverence that I should in that way? At the time this verse was written, the sanctuary was in a tent. It was in a place that was inside a tent, and God's presence was seen to be there. Later on, in a temple. But you and I understand, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, you can be turning back to 1 Corinthians 3, as he tells us there in 1 Corinthians 3, God is building a new temple, a spiritual temple, the Church of God. So he tells us here in 1 Corinthians 3, and starting in verse 16, 1 Corinthians 3, 16, do you not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? Just as the Spirit of God dwelt in that sanctuary in the tabernacle or the temple, the Spirit of God dwells in you and in me. If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. Am I honoring that sanctuary of God today? When you and I come into the sanctuary of God today, do our actions show the reverence that he commands us to have toward his sanctuary? The way we look, the way we conduct ourselves, the way we talk, the things that we do. Do we have the reverence that should be there? Let's turn back to Hebrews 12. This will be my final passage, Hebrews 12, verse 28. Hebrews 12, verse 28. We read, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. Honor is due to a lot of people in our lives, but most of all, honor is due to God. Just as learning to honor our parents enables us to avoid being lifted up in our own pride and helps us to respectfully learn from our parents, the proper kind of honor toward God enables us to have a humble and teachable heart so we truly can go on to perfection and become the tools God can use both now and into eternity in accomplishing his great plan. Very grateful to be with you today. Look forward to talking with you as we spend a little time this afternoon, and wish you very well until the next time we get to see you. And if you get up our way, be sure and let us know. We'll be glad to get together and visit with you up in the Allen area as well.